content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're in our second reading of the double issue dated August 17th, August 24, 2018. And last week, the cover drawing and a couple of the articles dealt with the Russian interference in our elections. And this week, we will start with some of the best columns that we didn't get to last week. So this from the U.S., titled, When All the World's a Stage. We are now living in President Trump's kayfabe, said Jonah Goldberg. That's a term from professional wrestling and means presenting staged events as if they're real. Just as pro wrestlers stage colorful fake fights, Trump specializes in conjuring up illusions, or kayfabe, that he himself comes to believe so strongly that others believe it too. This is his primary gift. Trump's demonization of the media is as the enemy of the people, for example, is mostly kayfabe. His summit with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un was entirely kayfabe, particularly Trump's ridiculous claim that there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Trump's staff tries to ignore him, but his rabid boosters just go along with the act. When the fake news inconveniently breaks the fourth wall of kayfabe by reporting that what Trump says is not true, his followers simply shout bias and cover their ears and eyes. As Trump told supporters at a rally last month, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening. So what are those in the reality-based world to do? The only sane response is to see the kayfabe for what it is. Don't overreact, and don't fall for the performance. This comes from the United Kingdom. Anti-Semitism in Corbyn's Labour. Jeremy Corbyn just doesn't get it, said Dave Rich in The Guardian. After the UK's three leading Jewish newspapers published front-page editorials warning that a government headed by his opposition Labour Party would be an existential threat to their community, Corbyn insisted last week that he was an ally of British Jews. The evidence suggests otherwise. Since becoming leader of the once center-left Labour in 2015, the hard leftist has failed to expel party members who deal in anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, including that Jews were complicit in the Holocaust. There have been anti-Semitic outbursts at party meetings, and his supporters have harassed Jewish Labour lawmakers online. Throughout it all, a passive party leader sat, watching and doing nothing. Corbyn's refusal to take action could be a sign of his true beliefs. After all, in the 1980s, he promoted a group that called Zionism inherently racist. More recently, he suggested that the hand of Israel was behind jihadist terrorism in Egypt. He has palled around with Holocaust deniers, expressed solidarity with Hamas and Hezbollah, and voiced support for an anti-Semitic mural in London of Jewish bankers, which he subsequently claimed not to have properly looked at. Why would Jews ever trust this extremist? Britain's tiny Jewish community has had enough, said Robert Shrimsley in the Financial Times. The three Jewish newspapers spoke out with an unusually united voice after Labour officials decided to add the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism to the party's code of conduct, but only after making a few telling tweaks. The amended code suggests it isn't anti-Semitic to compare Israel to Nazi Germany, for example, or to claim that British Jews are more loyal to Israel than the UK. Instead of simply outlawing anti-Semitic activity, the party decided to redefine it and punish those who complained. Two labor lawmakers who lost family members in the Holocaust now face disciplinary action for confronting party leaders. It's true that Corbyn has been slow to punish the handful of anti-Semites in his party, said Mehdi Hassan in Haaretz. But the real existential threat to Jews in Europe today comes from the rising far right, not from some misguided leftists. Look at Poland, where the nationalist government has passed a law denying any Polish complicity in the Holocaust, or Germany, where 9 out of 10 anti-Semitic attacks in 2017 were attributed to neo-Nazis. The feelings of Jews matter, but facts matter too. What a disastrous time for British politics, said Tom Peck in independent.co.uk. The ruling Conservative Party is self-immolating, dividing between one wing that wants to crash out of the European Union without a trade deal, and another that rightly recognizes such a move would amount to economic suicide. Labour should be demonstrating why it belongs in power, yet instead it is also tearing itself in two, with Corbynites attacking moderate Labour lawmakers as imperialist, capitalist stooges. Both parties are being held hostage by their most insane fringes. For sanity to be restored, both will have to split. And this is an international How They See Us column titled U.S. Alone in Sanctioning Iran. The U.S. is gunning for Iran, said Le Monde from France in an editorial. The usually erratic Trump administration has pursued a policy of conflict with Tehran with an unusual relentlessness. The first step, diplomatic warfare, came in May with President Donald Trump's unilateral pullout from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the 2015 deal struck by Iran, the U.S., China, France, Russia, Germany, the UK, and European Union to severely limit Iran's nuclear capability in exchange for sanctions relief. Next came psychological warfare in the form of menacing tweets from Trump threatening Tehran with consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered. And this week came economic warfare, as the U.S. reimposed sanctions against Iran, targeting financial transactions, imports of raw materials, and the auto and airplane sectors. In November, Iran's vital oil exports will be sanctioned. But what is the goal? Trump claims he wants a much tougher deal than the one signed by President Barack Obama, one that would require Iran to give up its nuclear ambitions and curb its interference in Syria and Yemen. Yet since Trump has reneged on one treaty, Tehran has no incentive to agree to another. This time the U.S. stands alone in its attempt to impose sanctions, said China Daily. International monitors have confirmed that Iran is in full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal, so the U.S. has no grounds to go stomping out of the room like a spoiled child. The rest of the signatories are staying in. China will continue to buy Iranian oil, and while Trump has threatened to close the U.S. market to any European firm that trades with Iran, the EU says it will protect companies hit with American sanctions. Iran, meanwhile, has its own economic weapons, said Kayan from Iran. President Hassan Rouhani has warned that if the U.S. blocks Iranian oil sales in November, Iran could shut down the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow waterway in the Persian Gulf through which some 20% of the world's oil flows. Our forces held military drills in the strait this week, and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says it can counter all potential threats and adventurism by the enemies. But the threat of sanctions is already hurting Iranians, said Sarah Saidi in L'Orient Le Jour from Lebanon. Many multinational companies that do business with the U.S., such as France's Total, Germany's Siemens, and India's Reliance Industries, are closing Iranian operations. The rial has lost more than 50% of its value since April, and food prices have soared, with meat costing 80% more than it did a few months ago. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in recent days, some chanting death to high prices and inflation. Many young people want to immigrate. The mood on the street is far from enthusiasm aroused by the nuclear agreement 3 years ago. Donald Trump has crushed all hope. We'll go on into our in-depth article, the last word feature, this week with a simple yet intriguing title, How to Be Happier. The most popular course at Yale University teaches students how to be happy, said Adam Sternberg. He took it and made you a cheat sheet. Professor Laurie Santos didn't set out to create the most popular course in the history of Yale University and the most talked about college course in America. She just wanted her students to be happy. And they certainly look happy as they file into a church, a literal church, Battelle Chapel, that's been converted to a lecture hall on the Yale campus on a sunny April afternoon, lugging backpacks and chatting before taking their seats in the pews. They've just returned from a 2-week spring break. The weather outside is gorgeous. Professor Santos is playing her pre-class Get Pumped playlist featuring the Black Eyed Peas, I Got a Feeling, and Let's Not Forget. All of these students are currently going to Yale. What's not to be happy about? Quite a bit, it turns out. The very fact that Santos' new course, Psych 157, Psychology and the Good Life, is so wildly popular, with over 1,200 enrolled students, suggests that she's onto something. When she tells me one day pre-lecture, college students are much more overwhelmed, much more stressed, much more anxious, and much more depressed than they've ever been. I think we really have a crisis writ large at colleges in how students are doing in terms of self-care and mental health. Then she adds, sadly, I don't think it's just in colleges. Santos is right. College students aren't happy. According to a recent survey by the American College Health Association, 52% of students reported feeling hopeless, while 39% suffered from such severe depression that they had found it difficult to function at some point during the previous year. In the face of this epidemic of unhappiness, Santos decided to design a course in positive psychology, that is, the field of study that focuses on well-being as opposed to psychological dysfunction. The thing that makes this course different is that we also focus on what I call behavior change, the science of how you move your behavior around, she says. How do you actually change your habits and use your situation to your advantage? In her very first lecture, Santos emphasizes to her class that she wants to teach them not just the science of happiness, but the practice of happiness. And happiness, it turns out, does take practice. But first, you have to learn exactly what happiness is. Of course, you don't have four months or a Yale student ID to take the entire course, so we've condensed some of the highlights. Class, please open your books to lesson number one. My finger is hovering over my laptop's mouse, but I'm afraid to click. I'm about to take a survey offered by the University of Pennsylvania titled Authentic Happiness Inventory. you can take this quiz too. It's available for free online. It's also a prerequisite for taking Santo's course. Students take the test at the beginning to establish a baseline for their happiness, then check in at the end to see how they've progressed. In part, this is to demonstrate that if you're unhappy, you're not alone. The reason I'm hesitating to take this happiness quiz is, to be honest, I'm a little scared to pop that illusion for myself. How happy am I anyway? The truth is, I'm not sure. Luckily, after taking the quiz, we have Professor Santo's course to look forward to. 21 lectures of up-to-date findings and proven methods to increase your well-being. You can take a version of her course online for free. It's available at CourseRA.com. But be prepared. Before we get happiness right, we have to understand why we typically get it so wrong. Try this. Make a short list of things that you think would make you happier. They can be big things, a raise, moving to a new city, a new partner, or small, whatever looks good right now in the vending machine. Okay, have you finished your list? Let's have a look. I have my red pen ready. Wrong, 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 wrong. Nearly everything you think will make you happier won't. Because nearly everything you're likely to list, assuming, of course, that your basic life needs are taken care of, is some circumstantial change, more money, a different home or job, a long vacation, or even that enticing snack that lies just beyond the vending machine glass. Your mind is constantly telling you that if you just got those things, you'd finally, truly, unequivocally be happy. But your mind is wrong, and science is right. Why? We find that out in lecture number 2. In her second lecture, Santos looks at the work of Sonia Lyubomirsky, a psychologist at the University of California, Riverside. Lyubomirsky is well known for her thought experiment about what affects our happiness, which she expresses in a pie chart. She proposes that roughly 50% of happiness is determined by genes, i.e., totally out of your control. Roughly 10% is determined by circumstances, i.e., somewhat out of your control. And the final 40% is determined by your thoughts, actions, and attitudes, i.e., entirely within your control. The takeaway is simply this. We are inclined to assume that circumstances play the biggest role in our happiness, when research suggests they play the smallest role. Lyubomirsky is quick to point out that this is only true if your most basic needs are met. If you're a Syrian refugee or stuck in an abusive relationship, then your circumstances obviously play an outsized role in your well-being. What's more, we grossly underestimate the extent to which changing our behaviors, rather than our circumstances, can significantly increase our well-being. What we believe would make a huge difference in our lives actually, according to scientific research, makes only a small difference, while we overlook the true sources of personal happiness and well-being. So what are the true sources of personal happiness? The best way psychologists have found to determine what makes people happy is to reverse engineer happiness by studying the habits of people who already identify as happy. There are certain habits that have been shown to be consistent among happy people. Happy people devote time to family and friends. They practice gratitude. They practice optimism. They are physically active. They savor life's pleasures and try to live in the present moment, as Lyubomirsky puts it. I know, you're all for gratitude journals and mindfulness and savoring the moment, but secretly you want to skip ahead to the part of the course where we talk about the question you're no doubt about asking right now. What about money? Money can't buy happiness is an aphorism you learn around the same time you're old enough to read your first fortune cookie. But Money can buy happiness, right? Otherwise, why are we so obsessed with it? To understand why we overvalue the role of money in happiness, let's skip ahead to a special event scheduled on the syllabus for right after the midterm. Pop quiz. If you suddenly found you had an extra $100, what would you do with it? Now, what would you do if you suddenly found you had an extra hour? With the money, chances are you'd be inclined to use it on a treat, to buy something you did not budget for otherwise, rather than paying off an existing debt. With time, it's the opposite. There's a good chance you'd use that hour to catch up on work, rather than go for a walk or visit a museum you'd otherwise not have time to do. As a time-starved New Yorker, I found this reversal particularly intriguing. 60% of working parents report feeling always rushed, and 80% of working adults, with or without children, would like to have more time to spend with loved ones. In psychology, this sense of not having enough time is known as time famine. The sense of having plenty of time is called time affluence. Affluence is a fitting analogy, as time and money are both commodities. We see them as literally equivalent. Time is money. We think of both as scarce and therefore valuable. We spend and waste and save them both. Yet it turns out we do a terrible job of valuing time and money correctly, in part because we don't understand the kind of commodities they really are. Here, Santos draws on the work of Ashley Willens, an assistant professor at Harvard Business School, and Elizabeth Dunn, a professor at the University of British Columbia, who have studied how we value time versus money and how our attitudes affect our well-being. First, we have to understand a crucial difference between them. As a personal commodity, money is extremely elastic, in that you can theoretically accumulate an infinite amount of it, and your income fluctuates at different points in your life. Time, by contrast, is intrinsically inelastic. You cannot accumulate more of it, and you've never had any less of it. You get the same amount of minutes and hours in every day of your life. By that reasoning, an hour should be much more valuable than a dollar. Yet we consistently behave as if the opposite were true. For example, would you accept a new job with a 20% higher salary if it meant a 25% longer work week or a 50% longer commute? If so, you are valuing your monetary affluence over your time affluence. You are what Willens and Dunn would call a, quote, Morgan in their studies. They use the figures of, quote, Taylor, who values time, and Morgan, who values money, and ask respondents to identify with one or the other. Interestingly, people who are reliably split evenly on whom they identify with. Yet the Taylors of the world report a much higher level of overall happiness in other areas of life. In another study, Willens and Dunn engineered an experiment in which participants were offered $40 and required to spend it on a time-saving purchase of their own devising. Some ordered takeout, some used the money on a house cleaner, some employed a neighborhood kid to finish up that lingering yard work. Later, the same participants were offered another $40, this time with the instruction that they had to spend it on a material good, like a book or an item of clothing. The test subjects were reliably happier when they spent the money to buy time, and they reported that their happiness was directly associated with that alleviation of time pressure. As for Santos, she came up with a straightforward way of communicating the concept of time affluence to her students. After the midterm, when they arrived on the day of the special event, Santos and her teaching assistants handed out flyers at the door of the lecture hall that read, "Class is canceled. Go practice time affluence. You have one free hour." The only proviso was that they were not allowed to fill that hour with work. They had to do something unexpected. Read for pleasure. Take a hike. Meet a friend for coffee. One student was so grateful for this one-hour reprieve in her overpacked schedule that, at news of the gift, she started to cry. As I work my way through question after intimidating question of my own authentic happiness inventory, I realized that the survey itself had pulled off a sneaky trick. Like the course, the survey got me thinking about happiness in a new way. So when it asked me to choose on a spectrum from I have sorrow in my life to my life is filled with joy, I had to admit that despite some recent sorrowful events, including a death in my family, my life feels suffused with joy. When facing the survey's final question, a choice ranging from my life is a bad one to my life is a wonderful one, the very act of having taken the time to reflect on what I have to be grateful for, how happy I am, and what happiness really means left me thinking that, yeah, my life is a good one, all in all. In the end, I scored a 3.79 out of 5. That puts me in the 80th percentile of happiness for people of my gender, age, and zip code. There's room for improvement, and thanks to this course and the research it draws on, I have lots of ideas of how to go about it. This afternoon, for example, I'm going to cancel an appointment and do something pointless for an hour. The first lesson of psychology in the good life is that happiness is something worth working at. The final lesson is that the class never truly ends. But for now, as scores go, I'm pretty happy with it. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in New York Magazine. Going to take in one of the obituaries this week. The name did not ring a bell for me, but his work certainly brought back some memories. The audio maestro who engineered Star Trek's sounds, Douglas Grindstaff, 1931 to 2018. Douglas Grindstaff crafted the sound of the future. The Emmy-winning sound editor was hired in 1965 to work on the original Star Trek TV show, and his special effects would bring the Starship Enterprise and entire alien worlds to life. By manipulating recordings on magnetic tape, Grindstaff devised the pneumatic whoosh of the automatic doors on the spaceship's bridge and the whir of its engines, partly a noisy air conditioner. He made the growl of the reptilian villain Gorn, a mix of sounds, including a person vomiting, and the squeals and murmurings of the furry, fast, multiplying tribbles, dove coos, screech owl calls, and squeaking balloons. Other effects required a more physical approach. He once recorded a 2.5-ton truck dumping dirt on the stage. The head of the department, he said, just about came unglued. Raised in Los Angeles, Grindstaff served in the Army during the Korean War and later broke into show business as a film editor's apprentice, said the New York Times. He was working as an audio editor at the Samuel Goldwyn Studio in Hollywood when Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry sought his help. Grindstaff soon discovered that Roddenberry would be a very demanding boss. Arriving at work one morning, he recalled, "The secretary gave me 11 pages of notes that he had dictated to her on one episode." After Star Trek was canceled in 1969, Grindstaff became a valuable behind-the-scenes player on hit shows such as Mission Impossible, The Brady Bunch, and Dallas, said HollywoodReporter.com. In later years, he would marvel at how wildly popular Star Trek had become after the show ended. If I had only known, Grindstaff lamented, I would have kept stuff like you wouldn't believe. And we'll spend a little time on the business page today. This page is titled, The News at a Glance. Tech, Elon Musk's Tesla buyout plan. Elon Musk wants to take Tesla private, said Arush Masoodi in the Financial Times. The CEO made the declaration via tweet this week, signaling a move that could bring an end to his fractious relationship with Wall Street. Musk has warred with short sellers who believe Tesla's shares are overvalued. His statement that followed news that Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund had taken a $2 billion stake in Tesla. The unorthodox Twitter announcement left investors guessing about how seriously to take the claims. Musk later told employees going private would free Tesla from wild swings in our stock price that can be a major distraction. Bankers and private equity investors have already cast doubt on Elon Musk's ability to pull off a buyout, said Miriam Gottfried and Carol Lombardo in the Wall Street Journal. Musk said in the deal he envisions Tesla's current investors could either sell their stakes or remain invested in Tesla through a special fund. But details about how he would fund the deal or when he would make the buyout offers are scant. And deals by big anchor investors to take companies private and protect them from the glare of public ownership often have to surmount opposition from shareholders and scrutiny from regulators. Food, PepsiCo's CEO to exit. PepsiCo's Indra Nooyi will leave the company this fall after 12 years at the helm, said Jennifer Kaufas in Money.com. As one of few women of color to head a major company, she presides over a corporation with $63.5 billion in revenue, the biggest food and beverage company in the Fortune 500. Nooyi's departure this October will leave just 23 female CEOs at S&P 500 companies. That's down from 32 in 2017, a decline of more than 25%. Women also make up only about a fifth of the board members at big companies that comprise the S&P 500 index. Media. Conspiracy theorists banned by more outlets. Right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones had most of his programming related to his InfoWars site removed from Apple, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Spotify this week, as said Elizabeth Williamson in the New York Times. Apple's decision to remove Jones' podcast on hate speech grounds led rival platforms to also take action. The move drastically reduces the audience for InfoWars, which sells diet supplements and survivalist gear through a radio broadcast, videos, and online stories spreading bizarre conspiracy theories and misinformation. Jones said he is being silenced by a plot involving Democrats, China, globalists, and corporatists. There's a side article titled, China Fears This Little Bear. Disney's new Winnie the Pooh movie, Christopher Robin, is notably absent from Chinese theaters this summer, said Emily Stewart in Vox.com. Though China gave no reason for rejecting the film, the problem seems to be that Chinese leader Xi Jinping loathes online comparisons of him to the bumbling bear. Chinese cartoonists have depicted Xi and Barack Obama as Pooh and his taller, thinner buddy Tigger. and Shinzo Abe, Japan's prime minister, get turned into Pooh and the donkey Eeyore. Z is so sensitive about the comparisons that references to the controversial bear have been censored from Chinese social media as illegal content. In June, HBO host John Oliver brought up Z's poo problem on air, saying his fear of the bear doesn't exactly project strength. Censors were not amused. Predictably, they blocked HBO's website and online mentions of Oliver himself. And these are a few short pieces from a feature titled The Bottom Line. First, even as rates for most other age groups have fallen, older Americans are going bankrupt more often. The rate has tripled since 1991 for those ages 65 and over. A total of 12.2% of all bankruptcy filers are now 65 or older, up from 2.1% in 1991. Vanishing pensions are partly to blame, as are higher medical costs. Also, many more older homeowners are still paying off mortgages. The construction industry has endured a significant labor shortage as young U.S. workers shun the building trade. The share of workers in the sector under 24 fell nearly 30% from 2005 through 2016. Replacements for retiring workers have been scarce, even though the work pays well and doesn't require a college degree. The newspaper industry has shed 45% of its employees from 2008 to 2017. Digital and television news couldn't make up for the losses, with total newsroom employment down 23% during this period, from 114,000 newsroom staffers in 2008 to 88,000 in 2017. And we'll go from business to the technology page. We'll start with the innovation of the week. License plates have remained virtually unchanged vestiges from the dawn of the automobile, said Eric Taub in the New York Times. No longer. The California company Reviver Auto is swapping out old-fashioned stamped plates for digital screens. The plates, which are connected to a cellular network, have a screen that can display anything, including vanity plates or a warning if a car is stolen. Businesses can also display ads on the plates when a car is parked, even targeting a vehicle's particular location because the plate is connected to GPS. The two-pound unit uses electronic ink technology similar to that of e-book readers like Amazon's Kindle. But the dust and water sealed screens used in the license plates can withstand wind and rain. Reviver has now begun a pilot program in California, though the first plates come with a hefty price of $699 plus an annual fee. More fakes on Facebook. Facebook has uncovered a new cluster of accounts, it says, engaged in coordinated political agitation and misinformation efforts ahead of November's midterm elections, said Robert McMillan and Deepa Sitharaman in the Wall Street Journal. The social network removed accounts with names like Aztlan Warriors, Black Elevation, and Resistors from its flagship platform and sister site Instagram. One lawmaker said that the accounts, followed by 290,000 Facebook users, were designed to sow discord, distrust, and division. The new wave of incendiary accounts raised the specter that despite the recent indictment of Russians linked to the Kremlin for election interference, those efforts continue apace. The Tough Math of Streaming TV. The transition of TV viewers from traditional cable to streaming alternatives is underway, said Jessica Tunkel and Tom Doden in TheInformation.com. But for Google's YouTube TV and Hulu Live, it hasn't been an easy ride. YouTube TV now has almost 800,000 subscribers, and Hulu Live has about 1 million. Unlike Netflix, which runs its own shows and a selection of licensed content, they're designed to replace a traditional cable package. But these streaming services have yet to figure out how to make money. Google, for example, pays an estimated $49 a month for a package of channels it sells to subscribers for $40 a month. If these services can't cut their costs, the more subscribers they get, the more money they lose. We're on the health and science page now, starting with the lead article, which is a reality check for Mars visionaries. The recent discovery of what appears to be a subterranean lake on Mars revived talk of putting human colonies on the red planet. But more ambitious dreams of terraforming Mars, artificially adjusting the planet's environment to make it suitable for human life, are just not realistic, a new NASA-funded study has found. Currently, the red planet's atmosphere is far too thin and cold to sustain surface water, an essential ingredient for life. Science fiction writers, as well as SpaceX founder and Mars enthusiast Elon Musk, have speculated that bombing the planet's ice caps, perhaps with nuclear weapons, could release enough carbon dioxide to thicken the atmosphere and warm it to a level that would enable humans to live there without spacesuits or airtight domes. But the new study has concluded that this plan would never work because there simply isn't enough readily accessible CO2 on Mars, New Scientist reports. Using data collected by NASA spacecraft, the researchers calculated that releasing all the carbon dioxide stored in the planet's rocks and ice caps would only triple atmospheric pressure, roughly 2% of the change required to make the planet habitable. More gas is likely stored underground, said lead author Bruce Joukowsky, but there probably wouldn't be enough to make up the shortfall, even if we knew how to release it. Terraforming Mars is not possible using present-day technology, Joukowsky said. Dehydration hurts concentration. When you find yourself struggling to concentrate on something, try having a glass of water. That's the conclusion of a new detailed analysis of more than 30 studies into the effects of dehydration, NPR.org reports. The researchers from the Georgia Institute of Technology found that going thirsty had no significant impact on reaction times and other basic cognitive functions. But for more complex tasks that required focused attention or coordination, dehydration did appear to impair people's performance. Examples include maintaining focus in a long meeting, driving a car, or a monotonous job in a hot factory, said study leader Millard Stafford. Higher order functions like doing math or applying logic also dropped off. Millard Stafford and her colleagues found that cognitive impairment tended to begin when people lost 2% of the water in their body. For the average person, that equates to about 35 fluid ounces of sweat, roughly what you'd produce with an hour of moderate hiking. And the health scare of the week, why soccer is riskier for women. Doctors have long worried that people who play soccer harm their brains when they head the ball, and a new study suggests female players may be disproportionately at risk. Using an advanced form of MRI scanning, researchers at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York examined the brains of 49 men and 49 women who regularly played soccer in an amateur league. Both sets of players had headed the ball roughly the same number of times over the preceding season, but the scans showed that women had 5 times more brain tissue damage than the men, with affected matter in 8 regions of the brain rather than just 3. Researchers speculated that because women have smaller, less muscular necks than men, heading may impart more rotational force to their heads. None of the subjects showed any signs of brain dysfunction, reports the Boston Globe. But lead author Michael Lipton says further research is needed to get a better handle on how many headers will get players into trouble. And we've got time for several of the Talking Points articles today. Let's start with 3D printed guns, a real threat. The age of 3D printed guns is coming, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Defense Distributed founder Cody Wilson, who has made no bones about his goal, which is to allow anyone to make as many guns as they want without government oversight, first published downloadable instructions to create an undetectable plastic handgun using a 3D printer in 2013. Such guns not only could be made at home by criminals or terrorists, they could be smuggled past metal detectors. The Obama administration forced Wilson to pull the files from his website, but the Trump administration reversed course earlier this year. A federal judge filed an injunction just hours before Defense Distributed began uploading the 3D gun plans, said E.J. Montini in the Arizona Republic. But it's too late to completely stop it. The schematics have already been disseminated around the internet, and it won't be long before creating a plastic weapon will be easy and inexpensive. This isn't a Second Amendment issue, said David French in NationalReview.com. It's a First Amendment issue. Defense Distributed was not distributing guns. It was distributing information. To order it stopped is to engage in prior restraint of free speech. Censoring these blueprints also is pointless, since plans for printing or making guns at home have been available online for years, and making totally undetectable plastic guns would remain a federal crime. The specter of 3D guns has created a bizarre political panic springing from the larger culture war over gun rights. Wilson's real purpose is to dramatize the futility of gun control, said Elaine Wu in Bloomberg.com, and every overwrought headline only gives him the publicity he craves. Gun control advocates shouldn't panic, said Andrew Sellers in Slate.com. The imagination runs wild if you think of 3D printers like the replicators on Star Trek, making perfect copies. But tests have shown these plastic guns would cost thousands of dollars to assemble on sophisticated printers and would likely break after firing a single round. Wilson's gun blueprint is actually little more than a political manifesto. Strange as it may sound, there is social value in allowing publication of this blueprint, since it would provide Congress and the public with advanced knowledge on how to respond to the threat of home-manufactured plastic guns, legally, technically, and otherwise. Information is not the enemy. Ignorance and secrecy are. QAnon. The ultimate conspiracy theory. A bizarre pro-Trump conspiracy theory is starting to break into the mainstream, said Jane Costin in Vox.com. In recent weeks, followers of QAnon have been front and center at President Trump's rallies, carrying signs and wearing T-shirts and hats emblazoned with slogans like, "We are Q," and "Where we go one, we go all." The movement is obsessed with interpreting cryptic messages posted online by Q, an anonymous internet user who claims to be a high-level government official or group of officials. QAnon devotees believe that the Russian investigation is an elaborate hoax, and that President Trump is actually working with Special Counsel Robert Mueller to expose and imprison an international pedophile ring that includes Hillary Clinton, President Obama, George Soros, and other Democrats. But above all, QAnon posits this: everything, absolutely everything, is going just as Donald Trump intended it. Is it any wonder that Trump's Republican Party is particularly fertile ground for this kind of thing? Asks Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. For decades now, right-wing hucksters like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity have trained conservatives to believe that everything is a conspiracy against them. Trump rose to power by exploiting this weakness, spouting nonsense about how President Obama was actually born in Kenya, and Ted Cruz's father helped assassinate JFK. People are susceptible to conspiracy theories when they're feeling powerless and anxious, said Gabrielle Bruni in Esquire.com. Despite Republican control of government, the president's base of white evangelical Christians still see themselves as losing their grip on the country amid rapid cultural and demographic change. QAnon, like the Trump presidency itself, is a backlash to that change. The liberal media love to give QAnon attention, said Peter Hassan in DailyCaller.com, even though it's unclear how many people actually believe it. Why? Because it makes Trump supporters look crazy. Sorry, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com, but whether QAnon believers number in the thousands or hundreds of thousands, it's disturbing they are eagerly awaiting the day that Trump locks up his political opposition. And it only takes one conspiracy nut to do something stupid. In June, an armed QAnon adherent blocked off the Hoover Dam to demand the release of documents that would unmask the liberal pedophile cabal. QAnon may be ridiculous, but it's not harmless. Pope Francis, a new death penalty teaching. As a traditional Catholic, I have learned to wince when I hear the phrase, "news from Rome," said Liam Warner in NationalReview.com. Once again, Pope Francis has broken with centuries of church teaching, this time to formally declare the death penalty inadmissible in all cases. Capital punishment, the Pope argues, attacks the inviolability and the dignity of the person, a dignity that is not lost even after having committed the most serious crimes. This flies in the face of Catholic doctrine. Previous popes, the great Catholic theologians, and Scripture itself testify to the righteousness of the death penalty in certain extreme cases to alert the criminal to the depravity of his crime and to protect the common welfare from evil. Francis is undermining his own credibility, said Edward Fieser in firstthings.com. If the church has been so wrong for so long about something so serious, then there is no teaching that might not be reversed. Mercy is also part of the Christian tradition, said Elizabeth Brunig in the Washington Post. During the medieval period, for example, criminals condemned to be executed could take shelter inside church properties. Francis' revision of the Catechism is more an evolution in papal thought on the death penalty that began under his predecessors, Pope Benedict XVI and John Paul II, than a change in teaching. Both expressed grave doubts about the morality of killing people to rid the world of evil. Francis is absolutely right, said the New York Times in an editorial. The death penalty is an arbitrary and hugely expensive barbarism whose victims in the United States are often black, poor, or mentally disturbed. Over the past 45 years, 162 people sentenced to death have been exonerated. It's likely that at least some of the 1,479 other people executed during that time were innocent as well. Clearly, the Pope is directing his message to the U.S., said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. More specifically, the Pope is talking to conservative American Catholics who take seriously the Church's teaching against abortion, but either support capital punishment or are doing nothing against it. In the shorter term, he's unlikely to change the minds of older Catholic conservatives, like three of the four Catholic Supreme Court justices. But generations of Catholic children will grow up being taught that the death penalty is wrong. The Catholic Church thinks in terms of centuries and millennia. It can wait. And a couple of short notes, maybe. Urban areas make up just 3.6% of the total land in the 48 contiguous states. But now 4 in 5 Americans live in these areas, and the number continues to grow at a rapid rate. And we'll finish out the hour with a quote. This comes from Albert Einstein, quoted in investingdaily.com. He says, "Technological progress is like an axe in the hands of a pathological criminal." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.